And so let me start by asking you a question. Do you think geopolitical perspective matters? And if it does, why so? Or maybe it doesn't, and let's maybe discuss it.
Why are you having the most? Why are you having always the most complicated question? Do people think geopolitically? Yes, they do. Do political actors think geopolitically? Absolutely. So does geopolitics or geopolitical perspectives matter? I would say yes, but I think there are two aspects one should bear in mind. One is that oftentimes geopolitical considerations are being sort of rhetorically sugar-coated or otherwise, you know, rhetorically embedded, that you don't really see the kind of geopolitical implications. So things may sound as if they are not geopolitically informed, but in fact they are. That's number one. And number two, I think at times actors don't think about the kind of underlying assumptions of their geopolitical thinking. And I mean, a lot of that has to do with geography, with territory, with something that is sort of spatial. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that is strongly embedded in social contexts, in terms of who do we think of as our ally or friend, who do we think of as our enemy or rival. Yeah. And I think that is what is playing out in a lot of the geopolitical, non-geopolitical rhetoric. Sorry for the long answer.
No, it's and maybe just to follow up on this one, do you think your thinking itself about geopolitics evolved over those 2 years? And just to give maybe to give a background, it has been second year that you teach geopolitics, I guess. Probably consistently thinking, you have been thinking about geopolitics over those 2 years, and just I'm curious, how did your thinking evolve, or whether it evolved at all from day one of geopolitics?
It would be terrible if it didn't evolve, right? So first of all, I hope that the older one grows, or I mean the more one reads about things, not necessarily the wiser one becomes. That would be terribly pretentious, but I mean, as such, of course, looking at things again, so reading assignments, for instance, that I read for the third time, and you still discover something new, or you see things differently. And of course, then this is also a big compliment to all the students who attended the class. I mean, I think instructors often don't officially appreciate the kind of impact that students have on their thinking, because it's a lot about debates, it is a lot about engagement, it's about being challenged. And I think at our institute, it is great that we have such a diverse student body, where, you know, students hail from numerous countries. And I mean, getting perspectives, for instance, by a student, we just had that two sessions ago, on the kind of thinking that Marxism plays in a particular way that Chinese international relation theory has evolved, I think is something that is fascinating. Mm-hmm. So yes, absolutely. I mean, it has evolved, and I mean, so there are numerous factors for that. So one is the student input, one is reading things again, and of course then the world is not standing still, right? I mean, there are always developments and events that are taking place, and I mean that of course also has an impact on how I think about geopolitics,
which is very interesting, because I remember you told the class and you told me that you designed the first course 1 year ago, I mean, almost 2 years ago, right? You designed the course before the war in Ukraine, so before basically 2022, and then the war happened, which made the course even more relevant in a sense, because I mean, suddenly, even if people didn't think about geopolitics before, especially in the West, they certainly do think a lot about geopolitics in Russia, in China, in India, in let's say BRICS countries. But at least in the West, like geopolitical term, like geopolitics as a term is a little bit of taboo. That's what also we discovered during the class. They don't really like to think that they think geopolitically, or at least there is certain, you know, taboo associated with the word in relation to Nazi Germany, in relation to like Cold War thinking, you know.
Well, that's how it's historically embedded, but at the same time, I think geopolitics is not something, you know, that is unique in that sense. I mean, it's just an additional analytic perspective grounded in, again, sort of, you know, the implications, political implications of spaces, primarily spaces, but also maybe flows and, you know, the availability of resources that are certain country has its at its disposal. But I think as such it is you see this change that now people actually use the term again, geopolitics or geopolitics or geoeconomics or geostrategy. I think that is also something that is now being reflected in different debates we're having about things like deterrence or about the role of the military or about conscription. I mean, you know, see, even in most Western countries that we have, depending on the state, different discussions about do we need to increase the size of our army? Do we need to increase military spending? Most countries answer that with a yes, or the political decision makers. And at the same time, we're having debates, even in the US, in the UK, in Germany, shouldn't we again have a conscription force, because we otherwise won't be able to defend ourselves. So, I mean, I think that is something that, I mean, often is presented in geopolitical terms, but as such, it is just an additional, say, lens by which we can try to understand certain certain events. But, I mean, coming back to the point that you mentioned with me designing the course back then, I really thought that, you know, this was against the backdrop of Macron's debate back then that NATO was brain dead, because that argument often has been misinterpreted, a little bit like Fukuyama's end of history. So, I mean, what Macron meant back then was just that NATO was lacking a strategic vision for itself. Yeah. So what is it that it's all about? What is its purpose? And that was, of course, during the Trump years when Donald Trump, I mean, explicitly said that, I mean, he was considering that the US might leave NATO, that NATO was obsolete. And I mean, that was sort of the beginning for me to think about geopolitics and NATO. I mean, how do the two fit together? Now, of course, then came what now has been called by NATO the unprovoked and unjustified aggression by Russia. Also, I mean, you could also put it simply in terms of the Russian war against Ukraine. And yes, of course, that changed everything in terms of the political discourse. But I think what we would like to discuss today is what have been the developments in the run-up to that? And I mean, do we see some kind of political developments or decisions that have actually made that development more likely, or that contributed to that decision? And I think based on some research you did, the interesting thing is that there seems to be not a disconnect, but there seems to be some discrepancy between rhetoric and action. So, I mean, we have this idea that starting in Bucharest 2008, that Ukraine and Georgia back then might become members of NATO. And then we saw, of course, the Russian invasion into Georgia back then. Then we saw the Russian annexation of Crimea. And within 14 years, it hasn't been able to sort out that problem. I mean, just to try to not picking sides, that this sort of conundrum couldn't be sorted out. What we see at the same time is that a number of principles are being upheld, such as NATO's open door policy and supporting what is referred to as Ukraine's Euro-Atlantic aspirations, which is a different term for NATO membership. And yes, I think we're still there. And the question now is, will Ukraine actually be able to join NATO at some stage? And will that process also be in the framework of MAP, of the Membership Action Plan? Because that's the regular procedure. And if we look at the history of MAP, there have been some you know, maps that have only lasted for 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm. and others have taken ages. So, for instance, yeah. If you look at North Macedonia, mm-hmm. which back then was the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia, Fyrom, they actually got map in 1999 at the Washington mm-hmm. Summit and became a member in 2020, meaning it took 21 years to actually, from the start of map to becoming a member. So I think one of the questions you ask is, wouldn't map as such be something that could be seen as unproblematic by the Kremlin? Because, I mean, even with map starting, it would just mean that it's a decision that will take a long time. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Ukraine might have become or might become a member as late as, you know, in the 2030s or 40s.
Well, now officially they actually dropped the membership action plan for Ukraine. That was the decision of the Vilnius summit 2022. The previous summit, NATO summit. And this is, again, interesting in a sense that it continues the same type of dynamic specifically from the Ukrainian perspective, when Ukrainian side is being promised membership. However, the West doesn't really deliver in a way that, like, the status of Ukraine.
With the West, you mean NATO members?
NATO members, yes. Like they don't really deliver what they promise, which is membership in NATO, and yet they still encourage. I mean, this is again going back to my research. They really encourage Ukraine to push further, as if they get the membership.
However, pushing further, you mean
pushing further,
politically, diplomatically,
incentivizing them to continue the same path that they chose, so to speak, which Ukrainians do. And again, here is also one thing, maybe like something I pay quite a lot of attention in my research is Ukrainian agency, which not so many analysts attribute Ukraine an agency, or in the way they attribute an agency in a specific way. For example, in my research, it's clear that Ukraine has an agency. Of course, it could draft any policy it wants to. However, it's also clear that it is encouraged by the West to have a specific policy in mind, because, I mean, aspiration is to get NATO membership. But as we all see from practical standpoint, just like from in terms of actions, what the West tries to do, well, it seems like that they cannot really deliver NATO membership to Ukraine, specifically because of the Russian objections, right? Specifically because Russia, I mean, now it's almost 100% clear that Ukraine does not get NATO membership, because Russia would just do anything to prevent it. I mean, it is doing.
The question is, of course, also how do you, I mean, technically can make a state a member whose borders are, you know, either still changing on a daily basis, simply, you know, empirically speaking, because of ongoing fighting, or otherwise, even if you were to demarcate borders, I mean, and having all the statements in place, you would then technically have to at least start a process with MAP or some kind of other accession program, where the way you treat Ukraine geographically is something that is fictitious in a way, because, I mean, you would then still uphold that mm-hmm. Ukraine includes, of course, all the currently disputed territories, or the territory held by Russia. And that, of course, goes primarily to the oblasts of Lugansk and Donetsk, but of course also Crimea. Because, I mean, then the question still would be, how does Ukraine in NATO actually look like geographically on a map? And, I mean, I think that's still an open question. But, I mean, irrespective of that, I think if we don't want to attribute kind of who is to blame for the entire situation, I think we can try to unpack the entire thing. And an argument you make in your paper, and I think one that is convincing, is that there is, and not least referring to that phrase of unprovoked and unjustified aggression, this kind of stance that NATO accession or NATO enlargement or potential membership for NATO doesn't have anything to do with the war in Ukraine. And I think, and that is something that is problematic for two reasons. The first one is it lumps together things that are, I think, are distinct. So, I mean, yes, there has been objection back then by the Yeltsin government, by the Putin government, also the short government of the Dmitry Medvedev, where, yes, there was objection, but not, like, I'd say, problematic resistance to enlargement of the first round of NATO countries. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so it was rather a development that the more NATO grew, the more problematic it seemed to become for Russians. So I would strongly object to the point that the Russian war in Ukraine can be justified because, I mean, people didn't listen to George F. Kennan back then and others, and NATO grew back then by including the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary. Mm-hmm. But I mean that now the future of Ukraine and maybe Georgia and sort of their political leanings, that this wouldn't have or doesn't have anything to do with the war is rather absurd, I think. So, I mean, of course, this is something what the conflict is also about, whether it is also related to imperial ambitions by Putin's government or by Putin himself is something that one might discuss. But I mean, as such, saying that this war is simply about imperial ambitions and it has nothing to do with NATO as such is, I think, something that, you know, cannot be upheld as a position. So, I mean, this is not to say that, you know, NATO is at fault and it's only because of NATO decision that Russia started the war. That's, of course, sort of the other strange position that some people hold on. That's not necessarily political left, but some people do that. I mean, people here in Germany, in the AfD, but also, you know, in the Wagenknecht camp. Yeah. So, I mean, I think those positions both cannot be upheld. But, I mean, if we look at the core of the problem, I think, it actually goes back to still the 1990s. And we discussed that in previous podcasts, that there has never been a European security architecture that materialized, that experts, people like, you know, John Mearsheimer weren't listened to, who back then suggested, hey, we could dissolve NATO because the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. Why not dissolve this other institution? It didn't happen. So, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to, you know, waste energy on discussing that. But what I think is interesting is that there is some kind of path dependency or geopolitical considerations that have now shaped American thinking in Europe, and that is decades old. So, I mean, in preparation for this podcast, I just had another look at the article that Madeleine Albright in 1998 published in, I have to check it again, it was not the New York Times, but it was the Financial Times back then, in which she had this principle that is still technically guiding US foreign policy or security policy and NATO policy. Back then, it was designed to guide the strategic concept, the new strategic concept of NATO, against the backdrop of Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary joining the alliance. And I mean, it said that basically the Americans were supportive of European attempts to ensure their own security, but at the same time, they were not allowing the Europeans to let loose and develop their own structure. So, I mean, back then, the fear in Washington was that the Europeans in the form of the EU could become something like a competitor for NATO, and that Europeans could act without, you know, coordinating their actions with the Americans. And I mean, they, back then, Madeleine Albright had her now famous 3 D's. So no decoupling, no duplication, no discrimination. And she basically meant that NATO countries, the European NATO countries and EU members shouldn't be able to decouple their decision-making from Washington. Mm-hmm. and Ottawa technically, but I mean, of course, nobody would, you know, listen to Ottawa only. So, I mean, it was clearly a stance by the Americans to say, hold on, we won't allow you to take your decisions that relate to European security without our approval or without us being consulted. Yeah. And it also said that the decision-making, so that's the duplication, that there shouldn't be any kind of NATO-like decision-making body within Brussels. I mean, it could just be down the road in EU buildings where Europeans could have decided their own fate. And of course, this thing about discrimination was the third element was a kind of, I think, nice move by the Americans to ensure that this was supposed to mean if NATO countries were members who were not EU members, that, I mean, this could sort of technically discriminate NATO members who were also EU members from NATO members who were not EU members. But I think this duplication and the decoupling element is still something that is shaping American foreign policy. And I mean, I think, interestingly, the only times when it really didn't play a role was under Donald Trump, because, I mean, he was not terribly supportive of NATO, to say the least.
Yeah, I guess one point to make, it's maybe to connect it to my paper, and you are right in a sense to say that I guess there is actually why I initiated this research, because what I noticed is that there is a lack of conceptual understanding or conceptual even explanation when you go and try to study the war in Ukraine. I mean, you clearly go into camp thinking, right? Because you have to blame, I mean, you don't have to, but almost like all other analytical lenses, they lead you to this kind of path of blaming one side. So it's either like putting like 100% blame on Russians. And I mean, I don't blame them for blaming Russians. I mean, it's understandable that Russia, of course, initiated war, and it's clear that Russia bears like, you know, a degree of, like, not responsibility, but it bears like the whole responsibility for starting the war. There is no way to deny that. However, if you don't want to blame Russia, or if you want to say in a way try to connect NATO to this conflict, you end up saying that, you know, as Mearsheimer does, that NATO is responsible for the war in Ukraine, which again gives you like this in black and white perspective, and reveals a gap in modernist thinking in a way, right? In the thinking about international relations, because you really don't, you cannot really come up with the idea that where American responsibility for this conflict is proportional to what they actually did, to reality, so to speak, of their actions. And then, of course, what also like the second point to make, what interested me is this American hesitancy to analyze their own actions, which also from the Western perspective, you can see in such terms as unprovoked and justified aggression, which again connects like to this idea that Americans or the West has, you know, nothing to do with this war, which is very interesting because it already kind of gives you a hint that maybe there is something there to, from a research perspective, to search for something. And then, of course, like this is like how I maybe came up with the whole idea of this research, because I wanted to understand, but what is the real involvement of the West, or what is the real involvement of American in this conflict? And then the way I wanted to do it is, I mean, you can say just to be as close to real empirical observation as possible. And, you know, in my hypothesis, what I did, I suggested that, of course, American, for them, like the idea to reject Russian proposal not to enlarge NATO is just this idea that the Americans are the sole authority, right? As what you're saying with Madeleine Albright, it is the same type of thinking. It's like that Americans are authority here, and they don't want to negotiate with Russia specifically because it means the compromise. If they sit down with Russians about the question of NATO enlargement to Ukraine, it means that they give Russia some type of authority here, which they don't want to do. So instead of having some negotiations, I mean, back in 2021, they decided not to have any negotiations or they decided to reject Russian proposal. So I guess that's what also you are saying, or that's what I'm hearing now from you in a way. So you still think, I mean, it's maybe comment/question. So you think it's also, and this was my hypothesis, so to say, we can maybe discuss a little bit later whether it proved, because I have a feeling that it didn't really prove. But this is the type of thinking that Americans have, that they're sole authority here. And do you think this thinking that expressed by Madeleine Albright, it's still the case in the sense that Americans think about themselves, I mean, either explicitly or implicitly as kind of like sole authority in European security architecture? Do you think?
I think they say that, you know, NATO is the key institution for security in Europe. Certainly that's the case. I think the problem you raise is one that you have to unpack a little bit analytically, in the sense that, first of all, there is a certain overlap of what Washington finds acceptable in terms of security policy or security stance and what is then being discussed and decided in Brussels. I mean, Brussels, meaning NATO now, not the European Union. And of course, there are institutional or procedural principles within NATO, such as unanimous decisions. So as such, as within the, or as in the Security Council, if there was any American objection to a certain position that the other NATO members might have or might hold, I mean, they could simply overrule that as a, technically as a kind of veto power. So, I mean, but I think something that American decision makers struggle with, or sort of structurally have to struggle with, is that at times they are so being considered as a kind of shortcut or shorthand for NATO altogether. So, of course, there is really not a single decision that NATO could take without the support of the US as the most important ally within the alliance. At the same time, I think that sometimes people, also the Ukrainians, as your research shows, actually treat NATO as technically just this kind of European headquarters of the Pentagon that happens to be in Europe. I'm sort of exaggerating a bit. So, I mean, I think that is one thing. So conflating NATO and the US, I think, is a problem analytically. The second thing is, what does upholding normative principles or rules and procedures mean? So that's the kind of open door policy. That is something that is, of course, rooted in concept of international law, of national sovereignty, that yes, of course, a country that also happens to be UN member is a sovereign nation and therefore can take certain decisions that it wants to. I think that is per se a principle that should be upheld. So, I mean, I fully support this point that the Americans make. The question, of course, then is how does that translate into foreign policy decisions? Yeah. And I mean, if you then see that, for instance, Ukraine has changed its constitution and included articles that explicitly refer to NATO membership, that it has made also decisions in order to increase interoperability with NATO forces, that it has done maneuvers in the Black Sea with the Americans, is of course something that someone in Russia of course must perceive as a kind of rapprochement or potential, of membership and short of map to Ukraine trying to come closer to other NATO members. And I mean, again, some people would now say, well, you see, that's just another proof why actually the Ukrainians are to blame or NATO is to blame for the start of the war. Of course, I mean, that's not, I think, what you can draw as a conclusion from what I was just saying. It's just that I think it's a very complex web. And I think for the Americans, it is very difficult to steer that path because on the one hand, they have normative principles that they want to uphold that are also rooted in international law. And it's good that they uphold those in principle. And at the same time, you know, you have a gap between rhetoric and action, and also how you then talk to or negotiate with other countries that are maybe not or no longer superpowers, but of course among the sort of top dogs in the international system, such as Russia.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is something that hasn't worked out. I mean, I think one can simply empirically state that, you know, no matter whom you want to blame, that as such, the talks haven't really resulted in any productive.
I mean, they were no talks. I mean, that's also the point to make, that no matter like how you perceive Russian suggestion to hold talks, I mean, it's empirically clear that the US just rejected the talks. I mean, they could have had some negotiations, and then maybe the result of those negotiations would have probably failed, and Russia would probably still started the war anyway. And you could say that, again, what they said, that they have nothing to do with the war, so why would we even talk to Russia? It's up to Ukrainians to decide their future. However, I mean, they still didn't talk to Russians. So, like, even on the just basic level, they didn't even try to talk to them. And this is, of course, interesting, because the gap that you mentioned, in a sense, the gap between rhetorics and actions, was leading up to the conflict in a way just detrimental to Ukraine and Ukraine security. And I guess I have this phrase in my paper, in the conclusion, that I mean, the US the US presented itself as the defender of Ukrainian rights at the expense of Ukrainian security. In a way, if you know what I mean, just from perspective of, they neglected actual Ukrainian security to upheld some, you know, rights that are up in the air, in a way that they are, you know, where those rights, they're not really real to the extent that Ukrainian security is real. And what is interesting for me, I think this gap emerges when you look at American actions prior to the conflict. This gap really emerges because of the constraint of American power itself, or maybe constraint of the Western power and authority. Like, what I mean by that, in a way, and I still do believe that this is the case, so if the US had enough power and authority to go to Ukraine and say, Ukraine is a part of NATO right now, and Russians have nothing, like Russians just cannot do anything with that, just take it or leave it, so to speak. Or you can, you know, if you want to object us, you have to deal with the whole NATO military potential. Or they should have clearly, you should have seen that there was a constraint, right? And there is still a constraint, because this this type of thinking repeats during the war. You have like those bits by bits of military equipment that NATO provides, like NATO and the US provide to Ukraine, but they are constrained in a way that those type of military equipment, they're very careful in a way how Russians perceive those military supplies. They don't want to breach a certain point when, you know, Russia...
You're not talking about before the war and after, still after,
it's
right?
The same, yeah.
I mean, it's still ongoing, of course, now arms...
Yeah.
You know, deliveries have increased, but I mean, it's sort of a... You see a sort of a ratcheting up of things, you know. Now we're talking about F-16s and fighter jets and a certain kind of tanks. And back then it was about, I mean, the first and ridiculous sort of German way of support was, I think, you know, helmets. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if we're talking about helmets and, you know, protective gear and maybe assault rifles, and that's a different kind of weaponry than, you know, sophisticated weapon systems such as, you know, air defense systems.
Well, because I mean, I would argue, and I guess that's not that stretch of an argument to say that, but because they are afraid of Russians, right? They're simply afraid of having a war with Russia, and they're afraid of having a direct confrontation. And yet, from normative perspective, they behave as if there is no one to, there's no, nothing constrained us. That the norms that they upheld, like the norms that they upheld, that those norms have a certain type of authority, to an extent that, you know, the US would go and fight for those norms. which is like so problematic on so many in so many ways that, I mean, leading up to the conflict, this is like, again, leading up to the conflict, it really resulted in this, what I would call a security vacuum, you know, that actually the US created. It wasn't created by Russians. Russians just saw this vacuum. And this vacuum, and what I mean by that vacuum is like the potential for Russia to show its power and authority, right? That, I mean, if the US thought clearly that, you know, they have constraints, you know, they cannot go to Ukraine, I mean, and fight for Ukrainian sovereignty as they, you know, promised to Ukraine actually in bilateral documents. I mean, I guess those documents don't worth that much as NATO documents. That's clearly the case. But again, it's like, just for me, it's like interesting to observe again, like, yes, there is like this, as you said, there is like this gap between rhetorics and actions. And I feel this gap emerges because Americans don't want to admit, even to themselves, like not to Russians, but just to themselves, that they are constrained by something. And by something, I mean by Russian
power. But I mean, the constraints come from different, you know, sides, right? I mean, one is, of course, domestic support. You see a country that, no matter what, I mean, even if you have approval ratings for, you know, now arms shipments to Ukraine as such, something that you could see from the first Obama administration, that Americans were as such were not terribly supportive of military action abroad. So, I mean, that's more difficult now to get, you know, the American population supporting military action by Americans. Mm-hmm. First thing. Then the second, I think, is, of course, that you have military action on many fronts, because, I mean, or potentially, because, I mean, it's something that you say something rhetorically in order to achieve a certain political result. And I mean, and in that case, it would be, again, a principle, I think, that you can uphold. And that is, in Central and primarily Eastern Europe and the Caucasus, there are countries who happen to be part of the Soviet Union who might want to become or do want to become NATO members. So, I mean, is that something that those countries should be able to do? And of course, then you have to think, in principle, yes, they should be, but then you that does collide with kind of realpolitik, right? That, I mean, irrespective of whether that is a decision that the country should be able to take, the normative side, you do have the practical implications that there might be some countries who object to that. And but, I mean, of course, that's what the Russians have been doing.
But I just like, maybe to steer up the conversation, and what's interesting, yes, there are constraints, and I guess it's pretty clear from the observation, right? Because there is, of course, American perspective, but there is also like real world, so to speak, that constrains Americans behave maybe in a way that they wanted to. However, like, they act as if there are no constraints. This is what very interesting, because
I wouldn't agree with no constraints. No, I mean, but I would say that sort of kind of the rhetoric suggests that they can actually, you know, pull more resources, or actually use more resources than they actually have at their disposal. And I mean, that is something that you now see playing out also with regard to everything that they are talking about when it comes to supporting Israel, or otherwise, you know, trying to contribute to a sort of calmer or, you know, less instable Middle East, but also with regard to the situation in Taiwan. And I mean, for American policymakers, it's just, it must, in the Biden administration, it must just be a nightmare at the moment, right? Because I mean, they technically have potentially three fronts where, I mean, the American military might be involved. And then that's certainly an overstretch. I mean, that is something that the Americans won't be able to pull off. So, I mean, in that sense, you're right. I mean, they are pretending that they can do more than they actually can do.
And this is exactly right. And in a way, it's also important to observe this, because the whole I don't think it's a coincidence that the whole conflict exacerbated with Biden coming into power. I mean, it's pretty clear that the whole escalation actually started with Biden administration. I mean, this is just clear from empirical evidence. And it's also clear from perspective of Ukrainian agency, because Ukraine didn't just sit and do nothing. Ukraine put a lot of energy, I mean, all energy it can, into accelerating this accession process. And it's very important if you think from Ukrainian perspective, because Biden was actually the person, has always been the person who, like, you know, almost messianically supports Ukraine. He has
certainly been more supportive than
anyone else,
Barack Obama and others. But I think if we do this kind of quasi crystal ball gazing, I think the interesting and maybe scary thing to think about will be what a second Trump administration could look like in that regard. Because I think, and I haven't done, you know, an in-depth analysis of that, but I think the Trump administration, or primarily Trump, was sending two different signals, or rather the kind of military establishment that Trump hired did pretty much the same thing as the Biden administration, and that was to support Ukraine militarily. And in that sense, everything as previous administrations to also increase the likelihood of NATO membership in the sense of military infrastructure, command structures, equipment, etc. At the same time, you had this bizarre summit between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin that most observers found deeply problematic when it comes to the American position towards Russia. And at the same time, of course, the Kremlin saw that Donald Trump was criticizing NATO, to say the least, or, I mean, basically saying that it was obsolete. So, I mean, the question is what, I mean, the Trump administration would do if it were to be, you know, elected, if he were to be elected. And, I mean, it doesn't look that unlikely. So, I mean, I'm just curious, because in that sense, it might also intensify that conflict dynamic. I think what cannot say is that the Trump years actually reduced the risk of the military confrontation per se. I think what actually made things differently was that Trump treated NATO as an institution very differently than the Biden administration. Yeah. But from, I mean, my more or less superficial reading of American-Ukrainian relations, there was also strong support for Ukraine under the Trump administration.
I think yes, the military support increased, I wouldn't say rhetorical support by Americans increased that much. And also I think Ukraine just wasn't in the spotlight of international politics back then. I mean, it mattered of course to Russia, it obviously mattered to Russia a lot. But as such, it wasn't that big of a deal that, you know, maybe was worth Trump time as a president, so to speak. It wasn't something, I guess, he was like briefed daily, you know, we send like this type of military equipment. It wasn't something that was really, you know, important for the US administration. And then, of course, things changed drastically once Biden came into power. And of course, famous, as you said, the famous formula of supporting Ukrainian independence, territorial integrity, and Euro-Atlantic aspirations, with emphasis on Euro-Atlantic aspirations. It's something that Biden administration came up. And then it brought up open door policy at the same time, which, again, if you think about just for these two things, and then you add like third thing, Brussels summit communique, I mean, to be honest, it sounds like Ukraine is going to NATO, like very soon, maybe, who knows? Like, you know, if it's up to Americans to decide, but even to leverage its power to make everyone on board with Ukrainian membership, maybe it's going to happen soon.
But I mean, I think that's. But I mean, all the other quotes you have, I think, boil down to the same thing that I just, mentioned with regard to North Macedonia, or formerly Fyrom. You know, that where it took 21 years to become a member after, you know, starting MAP, and I think there were a number of American politicians who actually, I mean, also try to convey that message. I mean, to keep that sort of timeline very in a very ambiguous way. That, I mean, yes, but MEP might come soon, but I mean that then MEP would result in full-fledged membership in a short period of time is something I think that Ukrainians hope for, that maybe they even thought might happen. But I mean, I think is what most American policymakers would either explicitly deny in statements and certainly internally. I'm pretty sure that if you were to look into, government archives that will be declassified at some stage, I'm pretty sure that we'll see that American decision makers were terribly, I wouldn't say supportive, but I mean optimistic that starting MEP would result in Ukrainian NATO membership anytime soon. Anytime soon meaning in less than 10 years.
Which is even more interesting because I think for Russia in 2021 and for Putin personally, it's even more dangerous if you think about it. Like giving green light to Ukraine in NATO with the knowledge that Vladimir Putin is gone. I mean, he's obviously going to be gone at some point in our lifetime. Going into the future with the knowledge that, no one knows how the succession process of power in Russia will like hold up in a sense. And Russian state is vulnerable. I think Vladimir Putin definitely knows it. And just going into the future with the knowledge that there will be some maybe turmoil, you can call something like, unstable time in Russian history, with the knowledge that Ukraine will certainly become part of NATO, and no matter like time frame. Again, I'm saying about just going out of office with the knowledge that in 10 years, in 15 years after like Putin is gone, Ukraine will certainly become part of NATO, makes the whole story even more like for Russia, like makes the whole story even more bad, so to speak. And something that like it's the risk that I think like Putin and Russia cannot take, so to speak. That's the thinking, was the thinking in the Kremlin.
But I would have two objections to that. And one is sort of an empirical thing that, first of all, of course, you see simply by Russian action that perceiving of NATO or trying to make NATO this kind of, aggressive alliance on its doorstep and, trying to invade Russia and everything is sort of not really taken seriously in the Kremlin itself. Because, I mean, once Finland acceded, actually the Russian troop presence along the NATO border, also to the Baltic states, has actually decreased. So, I mean, if there really was the perception that NATO poses a significant threat, one would assume that there is more troop presence. That's the first thing. The second one is...
Let me just maybe play devil's advocate right away. Because I guess it makes it more interesting. But what would you make of the fact that, I mean, Russia and Ukraine, they do have a disputed border in 2021, which is Crimea. And if the US agrees even to give Ukraine membership action plan, which means it's up to Ukraine to become a member. And I mean, then the whole story becomes, from Russian perspective, way much more, like it becomes way much more security threat. Because if you have like Ukraine, and
but it just basically means that the Minsk agreement, which was more or less trying to freeze the conflict, right, or freeze the kind of status quo, in Donetsk, Lugansk, and on the Crimean Peninsula, is something that that this is something that has to be unpacked. It has to be unfrozen in a sense, because I mean that's what we discussed in the beginning is that also. NATO membership now, unless it is done in a sort of process with peace negotiations with Russia at the same time, simply means that the territorial integrity of Ukraine is that we're talking about Ukrainian membership in pre-2014 borders, which includes Crimea, which includes all the entire territory. And of course, that just in... just in real political terms, without sounding too Bismarck, it's just something that, doesn't square. Because, I mean, you just see there is more than 15%, is it 20% of Ukrainian territory currently being, occupied, held by Russian forces. So, I mean, how could you possibly come up with NATO membership that, you know, encompasses the entire Ukrainian territory. So that's one thing. But I think I would, if you allow, discuss something else. And there I would be interested in your thoughts on this Russian talks about multipolarity, because I mean that would be the second point I wanted to make. Yeah. There is this obsession of the Russians to seek a more just international order. That is something that they share with the Chinese. That's what you can also see in the February 2022 joint statement of Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. But I think you can already detect some of the rifts between the two countries. Whereas the Chinese seem to be more into international trade and benefiting from a very specific kind of order that, you know, is to their economic benefit and maybe eventually to other countries being supportive of Chinese unity, meaning China, including not only Hong Kong and Macau, but also Taiwan. And the entire part that is on security is something where the Russians always talk about a multipolar order, right? I mean, the Chinese could easily say, well, we're the new Soviet Union. There could be a bipolar order, right? Us versus and our allies against America and the rest. But I mean, it's where the Russians really say, okay, we're also an important power here. And we seek to have a multipolar order. And I mean, if one takes that multipolar order seriously, the question is, of course, where are those or who does form those multipolar groups? And what does Ukraine have to do with that? Because I mean, if I were to think of it in a global sense or global setting, I mean, of course, Ukraine is a large country, but if you look at the globe, it is still, you know, rather also a limited geographic space, not least because it is within Europe. And I mean, if you have a Russia that has global aspirations, I think one could also think about, you know, Russia having global ambitions, be it in Africa. Well, they do have that, right, with Wagner troops, or what used to be Wagner troops, and with their presence in Syria. But for me, that is the thing where we said, yes, there are sort of rhetorical and otherwise analytical inconsistencies in the American position. You have open door policy as a normative statement, and then sort of the real political implications. It doesn't match up because some Ukrainian territory is held by Russians, so Ukraine cannot become a member. So you have this kind of tension. You have the same tensions with the Russian position, where you see, okay, first of all, NATO is a threat, and that's sort of dubious or not terribly convincing. At the same time, is what is actually, I mean, Russia trying to do in order to create this multipolar order? Because, I mean, it is very much acting as a European power. It is rhetorically now saying it is moving towards Asia and, you know, doing more in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But I mean, I still don't get that. Maybe it's not an analytical term, that obsession with Ukraine. I mean, the only thing for me, without having profound knowledge of Russia and Russian history, is that there might really be something related to, you know, a certain historical imagination, some kind of really imperial past that is somehow trying to be revived. But yeah, maybe you have an idea of what could a multipolar order look like that, you know, Russians are currently trying to set up?
Well, coming back to the ideas of my research, because as I mentioned, you know, I don't really examine in terms of, I don't actually deny that, you know, Vladimir Putin has ambitions, and it would be stupid. I mean, Mearsheimer famously says that, you know, he doesn't have imperial ambitions, which again just shows you the lack of conceptual understanding in international relations. Because you have to, you know, if you go all in with blaming NATO, it also means that you don't blame Vladimir Putin, which again, in a way, very very, you know, childish and very just rhetorically And so to speak, rhetorically weak, right? It's easy to attack this position, but of course, if you like, I don't deny that, you know, he, like, Vladimir Putin and Russia as a state, it has ambitions, and then of course you can analyze Russia, and, you know, Russia, as I argued and still argue, Russia is still Western state, and, you know, stuff that you can find inconsistencies that you can find in the Western position, and like the methods that I apply, they're also most likely very applicable to Russia itself. And Russia is full of, you know, inconsistencies and full of sort of like mismatching, and you know, sort of like this gap between, you know, theory and practice in Russia. It's very apparent when you, especially when you analyze Russia from inside out. But in relation to, I would say, European security architecture, I think like Russian actions, and then we came back to the previous points in our discussion, Russian actions are nothing more but anti-American actions. So for them, it's really important to say that, hey, we have a word to say here, like especially in relation to Ukraine, right? That's where you are constrained by us, by Russia. And for Russia, it was, at least to my knowledge, like it was like omnipotent to show it, right, in this particular case, that we are authority here, especially in relation to Ukraine, that you cannot decide without our veto, without our certainly say. And again, and this, I mean, and from Russian perspective, that really costs what it costs. Like it costs, you know, 3% of GDP growth in 2022, not that much, maybe in 2024. And what I mean by that, this is what cost that, you know, Russian government, Russian state, like is ready to bear to demonstrate to America that it has a right to stay here. Which from my perspective also means that in a way Russia is still, I mean, I would think in Russian subconscious idea, Russia is flirting with the idea that it is a European power. And actually, no, when you go and listen to Lavrov, he always mentions this, that Russia is a European power. Like it's really important for them to assert this principle. And which is again interesting, because going to Americans and the way America is talking about Russia, like the US wants to say that Russia has nothing to do with Europe. This is the whole NATO enlargement, because and like famously Vladimir Putin also told the audience in his address before invading Ukraine, that he asked Clinton, was it Clinton or Bush? I guess it was Bush. He asked Bush whether like Russia can join NATO, and he said something, you know, I wouldn't tell you the answer to that, but I didn't really like the answer, which is probably no. Which is interesting, because I still think what Russia is trying to achieve in the European security architecture, it just, like, first of all, it tries to have a word. And then, like, probably Russia wants to translate this word into some greater, like, so to speak, outcomes. Meaning that it wants to be, I mean, it's still important for Russia to have Europe as a trading partner. It's still important for Russia to have Europe as a market. And it will be important in the future. I mean, those ambitions, they don't disappear in one day.
Well, but it sounds more like ambitions. I mean, the sort of superficial reading I have is kind of, you know, cars that people now buy in Russia, unless they are sort of smuggled into Russia via Kazakhstan and places like that. It's a lot of them are, you know, Chinese smartphones. So a lot of the trade actually now has been shifting to Asia. And I mean, a lot of ties have been severed between Europe and Russia. Yeah.
But what is interesting, what does China want from Europe? Like, China wants European market. China doesn't want Russian market. China wants European market.
Well, because it's, of course, way, way larger. And that's why I said there are some, if you read that joint statement carefully, you will just see that, or you can sort of second guess which parts actually were drafted by the Russian side. Primarily, I guess, the security policy part, the economic part or the trade part, the political economy part, rather by the Chinese. And I mean, then there are, you know, there are some ridiculous ideas about millennia-old forms of democracy or things like that, or the different kinds of shapes that, you know, Chinese and Russian democracy play out. But I think there are some, you know, also underlying assumptions or perceptions that, I mean, if you read it, you can already have a good guess of what Russian and Chinese positions will look like. And I think for me, the the Russian perspective or what Russia is trying to achieve is still somewhat unclear. Of course, beyond ensuring that, you know, its backyard is not becoming sort of westernized, or that, I mean, that those countries at its west don't become NATO members. But I mean, beyond that, I think we can end on that and continue that conversation next time, is that I think your point was interesting, that the Russians primarily see the Americans as their opponent. And I think what one can take as an indication of that is that resistance to Ukrainian membership within the European Union has never been that much of a, you know, political issue in Moscow than NATO membership. And I mean, maybe just hypothetically speaking, it might be interesting to see that, whereas we have seen that historically NATO membership came before EU membership. To my knowledge, there has been no process the other way around, where a country became a EU member before becoming a NATO member. I think it has always been first becoming a NATO member, then a EU member. Yeah. That, I mean, this might be something that is reversed, or that we will maybe eventually see that maybe Ukraine becomes a EU member before it becomes a NATO member, if it becomes a NATO member at all. I mean, of course, that is something we'll see, that will play out in the near future.
Well, I mean, what I also mentioned in the paper, I think as long as Russia is there, like, Ukraine won't become part of, I mean, won't become part of NATO. I think that's pretty clear. And this is what this is what this conflict from Russian perspective is all about. There is, of course, I mean, again, I don't deny that there are like ambitions and like broader conceptual thinking by Russians, but from their perspective, this is what they're fighting for now. It's like to prevent Ukraine from becoming part of NATO and becoming part of the EU, I guess, as well. Because again, as you mentioned, if Ukraine becomes part of the EU, that's probably not a good sign for Russians, so to speak. And maybe one extra thought, just maybe to end up our conversation. But when I think about, and then maybe again, kind of like closing our conversation on geopolitical terms, like maybe it's just an idea. Maybe if you think really long term through both Russian plus Chinese perspective, what they're both trying to achieve is to create common space in Eurasia. Because again, what China wants, China doesn't want Russian market. China wants European market. And what Russia probably wants, Russia probably also wants Eurasian market. It really wants, you know, it's, you know, whatever it sells, like gas, oil, or maybe some other stuff in the future that it can produce, to sell it to Eurasian market. And if you think through the lens of like this Eurasian space that they're trying to create together, and what they need to do, they basically need to kick out Americans out of Europe. Because once Americans out of Europe, like both economically and from security perspective, then you have some room for something else. You have some room for Chinese cars. You have some room for Russian gas and stuff like this, which is like probably what they're trying to do long term.
And you have a larger role for the Shanghai Cooperation Organizations. And yeah, you see that membership growing. I think Belarus will become a member now. So I think this confrontation will be, you know, will continue. And I mean, you could consider that the SCO is basically Warsaw Pact 2.0. You could also think about it in this terms, and I mean in these terms. And it's interesting to see that countries like India and Pakistan, I mean, are also members of that. Turkey is also, I think, what is called a consultation partner, if I'm not mistaken. So I mean, if you just look at it, the entire Gulf states, most parts of the Middle East, then the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia,
it's now a big space.
That's a large space. And of course, that's also the area of the world where most people actually on this planet live.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is certainly something that Americans and Europeans have to, you know, deal with. And I mean, that's why they came up with all those, you know, new strategies, Indo-Pacific strategies, as they are now called. And of course, and that I think brings us back to the start of the conversation, is something that has, you know,
geopolitical
implications, or that is, it is a concept or term that is, of course, deeply embedded in geopolitical thinking.
I guess back to Mackinder and, you know, who controls
the heartland and the pivot area. So,
so
more than 100 years, we still have that kind of thinking with us. That's right.
Maybe there is something more to those. I mean, maybe there is some reality to those ideas and some in some like state as like spaces as organisms and stuff like this. But it's a topic for, I guess, another discussion.
That's right.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. My pleasure. And looking forward to talking to you next time.
Likewise.